Welcome to New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book on some area of sports, and we interview the author. This week's guest is Donald Spivey, professor of history at the University of Miami. We are discussing his book, If You Were Only White, The Life of Leroy Satchel Paige, published by the University of Missouri Press in 2012. Here's a question for all of you who are baseball fans, a question that I've asked past guests on the podcast. Name the three most important figures in baseball history. I'd say that most people will come up with the same names for the first two spots on the list, Jackie Robinson and Babe Ruth. But what about the third name? There's where the real debate would start. Don Spivey would make the case that this should be Satchel Paige. First of all, according to Don, Paige was the greatest pitcher in the history of the game, period. Both the Negro League players who faced him regularly and the white major leaguers who played against him in winter exhibition games agreed that there was no other pitcher with the speed and control of Satchel Paige. Owing to this extraordinary talent, Paige was also extraordinarily popular. And here, according to Don, is the real importance of Satchel Paige. Even though he played in the Negro Leagues and on barnstorming tours throughout much of his career, Paige was the biggest draw in baseball in the 1930s and 40s. Here was the real beginning of baseball's integration. Winter exhibition games, played in Western states, between white Major League All-Stars and black players led by Satchel Paige, and watched by mixed crowds of tens of thousands of people. Satchel Paige is typically romanticized as the old man of baseball, offering nuggets of homespun wisdom. But Don's biography shows us that Satchel Paige was much more like the self-serving, mercenary athletes of today than we'd care to admit. Paige was supremely talented and entertaining, but he also wasn't always admirable. Don's book offers a full portrait of the player and the man set against the backdrop of race, sports, and society in America of the 1920s through the 1950s. Here is our interview. My guest this week on New Books in Sports is Don Spivey. Don, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Appreciate it.
So I'll say in introduction that Don is professor of history at the University of Miami. He's been on the faculty there for over two decades, and he's published a number of books and articles going back some or more than 25 years on African-American history. And one subject, Don, that you have written about in the past before the book on Satchel Paige is sports history. And so I'll ask you how your interest in sports connects with your other research interests.
Well, but my first of all, primary love is history. I was a history undergraduate major, master's student major in history, and doctoral student major in history. But when I attended college, by the way, I attended on an athletic scholarship. I was a football player at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. This was in the 1960s. When I decided to quit the team, even though I was the starting tailback, I had a commitment to try and understand the dilemma that black athletes faced in big-time intercollegiate sports programs. And I teamed up with a former teammate who's still on the team at that time, Tom Jones, and we ended up doing a project titled Intercollegiate Athletic Servitude, a case study of the black Illini student athletes, that evolved into my and his first major publication back in 1975 in Social Science Quarterly. And it brought together quantitative data, et cetera. We wanted to look at graduation rates, patterns, what were the majors the students engaged in, and the history and context. So I've always had a running interest, personal and intellectually, in the whole area of sport. I mean, sport was not something you'd go on and do a PhD dissertation in back in that that era, so that was not a possibility. But it's always been something that I would research in, publish articles in, books on, et cetera, coming forward to finally the Satchel Paige book.
And I'll ask you then, so what led you, your early research was more sociological, what led you to the history of the Negro Leagues and Satchel Paige?
Well, actually, it was always historical. I mean, we always tried to reach a broad audience, to be sure. The Satchel Paige thing, this is very interesting. I mean, first of all, I was contacted by John Hope Franklin, mm-hmm. the great historian, who wondered if I wanted to do something on Satchel Paige because he knew that the University of Missouri obviously had consulted with him, and he had suggested me. I was doing all kinds of things on other aspects of sport and had interest, obviously, in the Negro Leagues. I taught a course on the history of blacks in sports. And thus we began, that is to say, myself and University of Missouri Press began a correspondence way back for this Satchel Paige book. And so it's really in the 1990s that I started focusing on that because so many other projects were going on. And this book took me 12 years of dedicated research and writing to complete because just like any other great project, and this was a great project, it was also a labor of love. Or, you know, we knew of Satchel Paige, obviously, and wanted to get it right. I was, like many others, tired of the loose treatments of Paige, the recycled stories, and I said, you know, we need to get a professional historian to do this, as General Franklin had suggested. So it became, for me, a tremendous learning experience over those 12 years. I'll give you one example. As Paige moved around, not only his birth in Mobile, Alabama, et cetera, when he would later play for the Chattanooga Tennessee team or with the Birmingham Black Barons or the Pittsburgh Crawfords, or he's at the East-West game in Chicago, and he's out in the Winter League in California, and then later in the Caribbean and so forth and so on. It meant for me that in all those locales and places, just like when he would have these great years with the Kansas City Monarchs, it meant I had to learn the history of that region, that community. As I joke with Bob Paige, his son, when I finally finished the book, because we talk all the time, interviewing them and have interviewed them for many years. I told him by the time I finished the book, I almost hated his father because he would go to these places, and for me to write it correctly meant that I had to become very knowledgeable about these places. Heck, I grew up in Chicago and thought I knew a lot about the history of Chicago, and I had to dig even deeper, learn even more to put Paige, as we as historians love to do, in historical context. So by the time I finished with Satchel Paige, I'd been around the world, right? And so I was worn out. But as I joke with Bob, I say, I thank his father for completing my education.
You cover the whole Western Hemisphere because he played from North Dakota to Venezuela.
There you go. There you go, right. So it means you just can't write about some trip or some experiences there as a historian. You've got to read the history of these nations. You've got to do research in it. You've got to understand what's going on to place them in the proper context. So that was almost hilarious, and by the time I got ready to actually write, after finishing all the research and saying I'm ready now to start writing, by that time now a bunch of new books had come out on aspects of places Paige played in and so forth and so on. And I remember as that summer approached, I had a reading list of 130 books that had to be completed before I could really start putting pen to paper in a serious way. So I thank you know, Satchel Paige for the education, for the opportunity, and for forcing me to become hopefully an even better historian.
Oh, that's that's a good way to put it. Well, I'll ask you, and this is one of the things that's been praised about your book is you do uncover new source material about Satchel Paige. So this is a story that had been known. You do bring to it the rigor and the research of an academic historian. What surprised you? So you knew the story well. What surprised you about the life of Satchel Paige in the course of your research?
Everything surprised me about him. Let me see. Early on, I think one of the most interesting chapters, and it's not a super long chapter, but extremely, extremely important, is his years at the Mount Meigs Reform School. The so-called, as it was called formally, officially, the Alabama Reform School for Juvenile Negro Lawbreakers. And, you know, people knew about that he'd gone to Reform School, and they'll make some mention of it and move on. But that became, that one chapter took me 2.5 years, even though it's a small chapter, to actually research it, to understand the history of Mount Meigs, to understand who led it, what was going on at the school, and it was just a tremendous eye-opener for me. I mean, the heart and soul behind the institution was Cornelia Bowen, a black woman who had come to the conclusion as she's developing this school that they needed to have a reform school to help save young black males, many of whom there in the state of Alabama, as early as age 10, were being sentenced to prison, to terms in adult prisons. And so this was one of their efforts to, in fact, save black men. But even the story of Cornelia Bowen, I found out she was in the first graduating class at Tuskegee Institute in Tuskegee, Alabama. Booker T. Washington was actually her teacher. But her brilliance, too, is her ability to see the role of sport. She developed a relationship with the Carlisle Indian Institute in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Most people don't realize, of course, that the Carlisle Indian Institute, where you get the great Jim Thorpe and Pop Warner football and baseball and all of that, Carlisle had a close relationship with the black industrial schools, particularly Hampton and Tuskegee, etc. In fact, it was modeled on the same model as those schools for blacks, only now it was supposed to be for Native Americans. They had a strong relationship there, and what she borrowed from them, ideas of using sport for reform, as Carlisle was doing and doing very successfully, obviously, with the noted Jim Thorpe and others. At her school, they would focus on baseball, and it was there that Paige learned to pitch. It was there that he later said he really learned to be a man, et cetera. And what's interesting, Paige never mentions her by name, nor does he mention by name Mrs. Meany, who was his teacher in grammar school, who we call Mrs. Meany because she would always report his absences to his mother, which meant that he would get a whipping for missing school. But Mrs. Meany was a part of the Alabama a Federation of Colored Women, and knew very well Cornelia Bowen. They were good friends. And so when she helps to recommend him to be sent, finally, is either that or he's going to prison, be sent to the Mount Meigs Institute, it was to save him. So the person, as I told Bob Paige, his son, I said, when I finished this and we were talking about, he said, if my father were alive, what thing out of all of this would you like to inform him about? I said, the first thing came to mind. I said, I'd like to inform him that Mrs. Meany, who was in fact Alicia Young, was actually his best friend, his guardian angel, and that the head of the Mount Meigs, who he never mentioned, Cornelia Bowen, was a brilliant woman who was doing her best to save him and countless other of black men. So that right in there, I mean, that's an education for me because this becomes an important, although not very well-known, institute in terms of this whole notion of industrial schooling versus liberal arts, etc. But also is at the forefront of using sport for reform. So I found that just fascinating. I didn't know any of this going in to research Satchel Paige. So I thank him again for that education.
And so you talk about that. He begins playing baseball in reform school. And so was his talent apparent right from the start, or was he a late bloomer?
From the start. I mean, the stories about him as a child hunting with rocks was absolutely true. Knocking sparrows out the air with rocks was absolutely true. He was such a poor kid. Throwing rocks was one of the things as a game and a sport he could do. They didn't have any money to do anything else, etc. And he just loved to throw and hit things. And he helped bring in food for the house. You know, they had a family of 12, and his mother was a washerwoman and domestic, and his father worked odd jobs as a common laborer on the docks there in Mobile, and cut grass and these other things. And so all the kids, when they were old enough, they did some kind of job. Paige, from, you know, hustling, picking up discarded bottles and that sort of thing. But also his ability with rocks to bring home ducks and birds and rabbits to help, as he would say, fill the pot. So, but what also sends him to reform school was the rock fight that he and his friends would get in against the students at the nearby white school, and that's the real reason he sent up to reform school. But I mention all the rocks is because and he had started to play some baseball in this earlier period, and the ability to throw rocks was transferable to the ability to throw a baseball, particularly with his incredible accuracy. So yes, it is very much demonstrated there. Mm-hmm. At Mount Meigs early on. Nobody could hit him. Key, clue. It was not debatable. Unless he slowed the pitch down to let you hit him, and there was no chance of that.
So we should ask, in talking about his background, how does so he's named Leroy Paige. How does he get to become known as Satchel?
That's in fact, while he one of his many jobs is working at the LNN track station, the Louisville and Nashville railroad depot, carrying satchels, carrying bags. They would meet people coming to the station and beg to carry their bags and, you know, earn a nickel or a few pennies, sometimes even a dime. Or when they're leaving the train station, run up to them and urge to carry their bags. And he came up with a device with a pole with straps to it where he could carry 4, 5, 6 bags at once, et cetera. And his fellow young black boys there hustling, they all joked about it. And, in fact, Wilbur Hines started calling him Satchel Tree. And in short order, they dropped the tree and just called him Satchel, and that stuck with him for the rest of his life.
So picking up on this this talent he showed, even from throwing rocks in the neighborhood or throwing rocks at animals to baseball at reform school, you write about how when he begins to play semi-pro and professional baseball, he plays upon the stereotype that whites have of the gifted but lazy black athlete. Can you talk about how that shapes his persona on the field?
Well, you know, Paige plays into that himself. I mean, he will always say that, you know, I didn't practice much, I hated running, and so forth. And when you go back and you do the serious research, you see that he ran with the best of them. He practiced harder than most. He was first on the field, last to leave, et cetera, in those early years as he's trying to develop his skills. Also there, you saw it at Mount Meigs, and the person who taught him, really, baseball and how to pitch, who was Moses Davis, by the way. And he was a minister in the area. He's also a member of the Board of Trustees of the school, and they taught him to pitch. But Paige also understood as he left Mount Meigs and went out there and started trying making a living pitching, that you've got to entertain the audience. Black athletes have always known this, and there was never any doubt that people come to a game, yes, to see athletic ability, but it's also entertainment. And that was always a difference, by the way, between black ball and the major leagues. Black ball understood, and in fact, it was a game that was played faster, more daring. I mean, why throw a person out at first base with an overhand throw if you can throw the ball between your legs and get it there? You know, I mean, the crowd loves that. Why just strike a person out? Why not walk around the mound and tell people what you're fixing to throw next to strike the person out? I mean, that's dangerous business, but if you're Paige, you can do it. And they can't hit the ball. As Double Duty Radcliffe told me, he said, they knew what was coming. He said, but you can't hit what you can't see. I mean, the ball is going that fast. There's nothing you can do about it. Right? So he knew it. He was playing to these things, just like about his age. Paige carried this on for the rest of his life about how old he was, and the media just loved it. Paige knew full well when he was born and in what year, but the media loved that. The old man, you know, what's his age? He doesn't know what his age is, and that kept him in the media. He's a very savvy individual in playing to what I would argue becomes modern-day sport. Modern-day sport is not just about athletic performance. It's also about entertainment.
So you talked about some of the differences between black baseball and white baseball, notably the showmanship and just the pace of the game in black baseball. I want to ask you about the structure of black baseball in the South, because when Paige starts playing professional baseball, he's hopping from team to team to team to team. So can you tell us about how these teams were organized and why was it that a player like Paige would move around really from season to season?
Yeah, that was one of the common aspects of the Negro Leagues, as they were called. And, you know, the leagues, the National League is formed in 1920 there in Kansas City, Missouri, et cetera. And it was basically six teams in the National League and six teams in the American League. But the number of Negro League teams will expand and contract, At its height, you had maybe 66 teams in total. But for most years, you're talking about, 12, 15, 18 teams, that sort of thing. But the idea of jumping was very, very common, that if you're a good player, if you're a Josh Gibson, the greatest, you know, hitter in the history of the Negro Leagues, as some people call him, the Black Babe Ruth, and then as Black said, no, you got it wrong, Ruth is the white Josh Gibson. Josh Gibson was a tremendous talent, and there would be teams that would vie for his name recognition and his ability with a bat. And so they would offer you a couple $100, come play a game with them, and so forth and so on. So it was very common for players to jump, not only for a game, but sometimes they might jump, you know, for a season. Because, as people would like to say, the Negro League contract wasn't worth the paper it was written on. And that was a common problem there. And Paige took tremendous advantage of this notion of jumping as his reputation grew. I mean, everybody knows that a baseball game starts and begins with what? The pitcher. If you've got a great pitcher, you've already made it, you've increased your chances a million times that you can win this game. I think Buck O'Neill put it best. He said the teams he was on with Satchel Paige, of course, including the Kansas City Monarchs, he said, we were really a very good team. He said, but with Paige pitching, we were a great team. And so that was the difference. So, yes, he jumped all the time. He was a fast baller for hire. And that was also one of the problems certainly for the leagues and one that Rube Foster, the brainchild behind the idea of the stabilizing Negro League baseball and his work with the Chicago American Giants. I mean, he wanted to stop this jumping. He wanted some balance there and greater stability there. It would come to some degree, but not fully, you know, because in the case of a Satchel Paige, and later even Gus Greenlee, the owner of Crawford's, would agree, as would later the owner of the Kansas City Monarch, J.L. Wilkinson, where Paige would finish his illustrious career, they would rent him out. They would rent Paige out. They would be partners in the jumping for games here and there and so forth, and get a cut of the money, because Satchel Paige was such a name recognition that he helped teams, other teams, make the payroll. You know, you might be playing a game, two teams playing, and you're going to have maybe 2,000 people there. Okay, but if Satchel Paige is there, you may have 20,000. That was a heck of a difference. His name recognition did that. He was the biggest draw by far in Negro League baseball, and as he was moving to the majors, he became the next best thing since Babe Ruth. And packing them in the stadium.
So he jumped around from team to team in the Negro Leagues, but then he also played in 1930, he played in Cuba, and later in his career he plays in the Dominican Republic and in Mexico, Venezuela. Can you talk about that, of African-American players moving into the Caribbean, into Mexico, South America, as part of their where they were jumping to?
Yeah, in fact, I mean, early on, even in the teens, 1919, et cetera, Rube Foster, some of the others, were playing games in Latin America, in the Caribbean. So it was always a welcoming environment. And Paige, like others, would start playing. He started playing there in the 20s, and would continue it on through his career. They loved playing in Cuba, in Venezuela, in Mexico. Because first of all, it was great baseball, and you know, Cuba was never a pushover. I mean, so you go down there, you're gonna have to seriously play some baseball. You know, the Latin countries are very good at this game. Mexico, come on, you're gonna have to play some serious baseball. But what is common among all the Negro League players, and I interviewed, goodness, I forget how many, at least 60 something of them. And all of the better ones who played down there, they said one thing in common: how well you were treated. You were treated like a man. You were treated like an equal. We stayed at good hotels. You know, we had room service. We ate at restaurants, etc. It was none of this Jim Crow stuff that experienced in the United States. So the irony was, and you'd hear this constantly from the players, is that I wish we were treated in our own country the way we're treated in Cuba and Mexico and Venezuela and so forth and so on, Puerto Rico, et cetera.
So in 1932 and 1934, Paige settles for a time with Pittsburgh Crawfords, one of the most famous franchises, sure, of the Negro Leagues. But then in 1935, he heads off, and I admit, this is one of the stranger episodes in the biography. I had difficulty with this. He heads off to North Dakota. So yeah, can you talk about what he was doing there, and really why that's significant, looking at the history of baseball?
Oh, it's very significant. I mean, Paige had played out west, particularly in the so-called California leagues, or many people would refer to it as the Winter League out west, and you could play with different teams beyond California. They knew of him in North Dakota, and Mr. Churchill, who owned the Bismarck team, he was desperate to have the very best baseball team in North Dakota.
Is this minor leagues, or is this semi-pro? What is this then?
This is semi-pro.
Okay, okay.
Right. And they will later play in the what's called the Post Championship, run by the Denver Post newspaper, etc. It is basically semi-pro. And Negro League teams can compete in it, etc., and so forth. And they would be some teams comprised of a number of major league whites who are, you know, playing in that as well, because there was money to be had. You could win the Denver Post thing and win like $5,000, which was serious money in the 1930s. But he ends up again jumping from the Crawfords, particularly in 35. He'd done it in 34 too, but particularly in 35, to go and play for Churchill and his group out there, frankly, because of the money. I mean, he was offering paid something like $1,000, for these three major games. That was a lot of money in that period of time. And in fact, as they're moving into the championship for the Denver Post semi-pro championship back in 35, Page goes, he takes a double duty Ratcliffe with him. Ratcliffe is on that team and some other players as well. And it's a completely integrated team, you know, with six blacks and six whites on this team. I mean, it's absolutely, and there, this is really a story of the first integrated baseball team. I mean, you can talk integration when a black barnstorming team plays a all-star white barnstorming team, but that's not an integrated team. That's a contest of blacks and whites playing against each other in a baseball game. But this was an actual integrated team. So much integrated, there were times when they stopped at hotels that didn't have enough room, and they shared rooms. And you have actually blacks and whites bunking together in the same room. That's absolutely a first, and I was glad to record it in the book. And I like the attitude of the Bismarck team. When they met discrimination, like a restaurant that said, no, we don't serve Negroes here, the whole team left. The whole team would not eat there. And so, as they said, that we walked as a team, we played as a team, we stayed as a team. And they won. As a team, and it was not just because of Page, but it's interesting. Both Satchel Paige and his good buddy, Double Duty Ratcliffe, both said, I asked, what was the highlight of the best team you ever played with? Now, you would think Page might say the Crawfords or the Kansas City Monarchs or, you know, my great thrill in the East-West All-Star Game. The
Cleveland Indians that won the World Series.
Right, exactly. No. The Bismarck team. They both said the same thing, the Bismarck team. But it was so extraordinary, and that they were teammates with whites, and everybody hustled and played their best, and it was one of the great experiences in their life. What's also happening there is they're striking really some of the first blows for integration. I mean, they're doing it, demonstrating it, as a team, by in symbol of they show up as an integrated team. Their success demonstrates it as well. And then when you're able to talk to some of the players who were on that 35 team, I quote several of them who said, you know, it was just such a pleasure, and how they would sit around in one of the rooms at night and play poker, and Double Duty Ratcliffe said that he won all the money. Well, but they'd sit around and they joke and they talk and they talk about various things with Page, of course, you know, center stage, telling all these stories and all these lies, etc. And they just got along as a team that you would later see in so many other teams. But they're really groundbreakers in that. And I think Page understood that, and certainly years later, and Double Duty did as well. So, no, it's not the Cleveland Indian experience. That would be, as you would say, a great experience. No, it was the 1935 Bismarck team.
Now, you did mention, too, these games between black all-star teams and white all-star teams. And can you talk about that? Because Page does this really throughout his career. When does he start doing that? And what's the importance of these barnstorming or exhibition games he was playing?
Yeah, right. He starts doing that when he goes out and plays in the California Winter League in the 1930s. And his name reputation is just skyrocketing. It's ironic. You talk about the depression years of the 30s. That's when Page's reputation soars to some of his highest during the depression years, and for many of the black ball players, because their game becomes sort of the game of high quality, et cetera, and so forth. They typically outdrew the white majors. At any rate, what drew people in would be the two all-star teams that the two developers, one black, one white, came up with this notion of pitting Negro League all-stars against white major all-stars out there in the California winter league. Tom Watson was one, and I forget the name of the other guy, that they would pit these groups against one another. And remember, white major leaguers were eager to do this too, because they're not well paid either. Mm-hmm. Right? They want the extra money, et cetera. And this idea, I mean, just really took off. They're packing them in, 15, 20,000 a game, sometimes 30, et cetera. In fact, Landis, the commissioner of baseball at the time, gets upset about this, because they're doing better in a sense out there playing in these winter leagues than back with the majors. Plus, his argument was that the major league players had everything to lose, and the black ball players had everything to gain. And to a sense, that was true, because the black players, to a man, told me the same thing, that when they had the opportunity to play white major league players, they played their finest game, because here was an opportunity to make a statement that I, too, could be playing in the major leagues if it wasn't for the color line. I'm just as good, if not better than you. And it's in that environment that no one in their right mind could question Satchel Paige's abilities or that he should have been in the majors. When you could go up constantly against the best pitchers of the major leagues and outpitch them, including the great Dizzy Dean, including the great Bob Feller. I had, of course, the opportunity to interview Bob Feller. That's a story in itself. But you had these opportunities, and you show what you can do. I mean, the statements by the great Joe DiMaggio, which he made several times, saying that the toughest pitcher he ever faced was Satchel Paige, and that he knew he was ready for the majors when he finally got a hit off of Satchel Paige. Or the statements by Dizzy Dean on his radio program when they were asking him about the other greatest pitchers he'd ever met, and without hesitation, he said, the greatest pitcher I ever met by far was Satchel Paige. And he said, oh, really? He said, yeah. He said, I was known for my fastball, but my fastball looked like a change of pace up against that bullet that Satchel threw in there. And Dizzy Dean went on to say, it's a shame, that we both weren't on the same team in St. Louis. He said, if we were on the same team, both of us pitching, we would have had the pennant sewn up by spring, and he said, and gone fishing into a World Series time. I mean, that was right. And there's no question about his greatness as a pitcher by major leaguers who faced him in the winter leagues. So those winter league games were very important, and the black press particularly would use this in making its statements over and over again about the unfairness of the color line, and how Major League Baseball is suffering. And when they see a weak team not doing well, they say, well, how would your team be doing if you had Satchel Paige pitching, if you had Double Duty Radcliffe on your team, if you had Josh Gibson catching and batting, et cetera, and Chet Brewer, and they'd go on and on, Judy Johnson, so forth and so on. This is just great talent proving itself. So those winter games are very important, because they are contests, where blacks can play against whites, and people can witness the unfairness of the color line.
So following up on the praise that white baseball players had for Satchel Paige, there were critics of Satchel Paige, and interestingly, sure, it was the owners of Negro League teams who were his critics. So could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, Satchel Paige was his own person And what I point out in the book, he by no means was perfect. And Page was a very hard-nosed business person. He was not a good investor. He didn't save well. He didn't invest his money wisely or anything like that. But, boy, he was a hard negotiator. And his rule was, you have to pay me what I'm worth or I'm not doing it. And that was very clear. He saw the stranglehold that the Negro League owners, in a very real sense, they were no different than white major league owners in terms of, we know back in that era, the baseball players were not being paid what they deserve. I mean, there'd be the exceptions, of course, Babe Ruth or somebody. But in the main, they were not making the kind of money they're making these days. And, of course, that was the same in the Negro Leagues. Page, though, understood his value. He understood, if I play in a game and you put out there on the billboard and the rest and all the flyers, Satchel Paige pitching, that you're going to double, quadruple those people buying tickets. He said, that means that I should be making more money. And he was by far the highest paid player in the Negro Leagues. And he had an attitude to go along with it. Think about it. No owner wants some player who's so uppity that tells you, I won't play unless you pay me more. Right? If you don't pay me more, okay, fine, I'll jump to another team. Meanwhile, good luck in getting people to fill your stands. And so Page, in that regard, was always, there was an uneasy balance with him and the Negro League owners because of that, and because of the fact that he would jump on you, just like he did Gus Greenlee in the Crawfords to go to the 35 Bismarck team. I mean, the Crawfords, Gus Green, they had just signed the contract. They had just signed the contract. And, you know, in short order, here goes Page jumping because I can make more money there. And then if he would go off, of course, to Latin America and that stint with in Trujillo and the Dominican Republic in 37 and so forth, and take so many of the great all-stars with him. I mean, there are bans against Page, you know, by Negro League owners. But these bans never held, and they wouldn't hold because he was such a draw. Mm-hmm. That was the bottom line. And J.L. Wilkinson, one of the few white owners in the Negro Leagues, and who would have, in fact, the most successful team in the Negro Leagues in terms of making money, et cetera, he understood this, and he took Page in when Page had all the arm troubles later on in the late 30s, and he took Page in because he knew with his high name recognition, he could still bring people to the ballpark, even if he just did some shadow ball and through some bloopers, and he invested in that. And in the end, his investment paid off because Page's arm healed, and then he was able to play full-time regular ball and was back to his great self again. And you had many owners furious with Wilkinson about that. But the other reality was, in the end, most of them would have to concur that Satchel Paige was the Negro Leagues. I mean, you know, it's like Muhammad Ali in boxing in the heyday. You could say what the heck you wanted to say, but we all make more money if Ali's fighting. We all make more money, as they said, in pro basketball, during the Michael Jordan era. And people were asking, don't other teams just hate the notoriety of Michael Jordan? And they said, no. Not when you're scheduled against the Chicago Bulls and Michael Jordan, because attendance goes way up. We all benefit from it. That was the case with Satchel Paige. And you found very few players who talked poorly about Paige because of that factor. Also because with other players, he never showed this, I'm better than you, to the contrary. And that was just not in his persona. But for owners, owners had problems with him. He was arrogant in that regard. He knew what he was worth, and he demanded that you pay him what he was worth, or he'd go pitch for somebody else. And owners traditionally have not liked those kinds of ball players or sportsmen, no matter what the sport.
So I'll ask, we're almost out of time, Don. I'll ask a couple of questions to assess Satchel Paige. And first of all, is that Satchel Paige is a baseball player. So where would you put him? You've looked at the accounts of many of his games. I don't know if you kept track of the statistics, but you know, looking at the list of the all-time great pitchers, where would you put him on that list?
As the greatest pitcher that ever lived.
Without hesitation.
Without hesitation. Remember, I'm in my 60s, so I saw the great mm-hmm. Sandy Koufax. I saw Bob Gibson, all these great, fabulous pitchers, many of them. I admire. I interviewed the great Bob Feller. Right, I never saw him pitch, but I've seen tapes of him pitching. Wow, you know, and of course the great Dizzy Dean, and so forth and so on. Without hesitation, Satchel Paige. Look, Bill Veeck, I think, put it best. He said, "If Satchel Paige come into the majors when he was in his prime, today's Cy Young Award would be known as the Satchel Paige Award."
Well, then I'll ask, going back to the phone call you got from John Hope Franklin, why is this great baseball pitcher deserving of an academic biography? What is the significance of Satchel Paige beyond his ability to throw a baseball?
What I think is so significant about Paige is that his life travels through much of the African American experience from his lifetime, 1906 to 1982. I mean, from the Jim Crow era through the Great Depression, through World War II, right, as I call that chapter, the Double V, which he and other blacks and others hope for, victory over there and victory at home against racism and discrimination. Except he travels through the 50s. Right, the McCarthy era, et cetera, the problems with the FBI, and so he travels through the civil rights era, right? And much of his philosophy seemed to match up better with black power than it did the nonviolent direct action of Martin Luther King Jr. He lives through this whole thing. I mean, there are lynchings in the South, and one of the things I was so proud to document was that these black ball players contributed to anti-lynching campaigns. I don't know if others in looking at this just not aware or not concerned. This is very important. His good friend, who was best man at his wedding, was the famous Bojangles Robinson, one of the greatest dancers of all time. But many forget that Bill Bojangles Robinson was committed to helping black youngsters. Troubled youngsters like the past he had had, like the past Satchel Paige had had, and so many others. And they contributed money. They contributed talks and lectures and so forth. Those things are usually forgotten, and people just want to talk about, you know, Paige and Negro League ball players and talk about the sexual escapades, funny stories. And you have that in my book. I mean, you get some of that. But it's much more important, I think, as a historian to talk about the historical context. And as I say with Satchel Paige, this is the story of the man who, really a little less than more than a fourth grade education, who helped strike out Jim Crow.
So, Don, you were working on this biography for 12 years. What are you working on now? What's the new project?
I'm finishing up a project that I began many years ago, right, and finally finishing it up. It's on the Bates Must Play movement at New York University that started in 1939 and ended right at the beginning of America's entry into World War II, about Leonard Bates, who was a black football player who was a victim of the Gentleman's Agreement. Was not allowed to play with his team, the New York Violets, when they played against white teams who invoked the Gentleman's Agreement back then, that you leave your black player at home. And so that one I'm finishing up, and that one, it's such a story, ongoing story, of the Bates Seven, the students there who led the protest to change all of this. And to my great privilege, I got to interview all of them. They were still alive as I was starting this and doing this. And Evelyn Witkin, one of the leaders, is still around. She won, by the way, a couple years ago, the Medal of Freedom for science awarded to her. She's just a great intellect. She was one of the Bates Seven. And part of that project, we were able to get New York University, which had back in the 40s suspended all these students. We got New York University in 2000 to apologize for that. Not only that, but to recognize these students as having been at the forefront of the civil rights movement. And that, by the way, made the front page of the New York Times. So we were very proud of that.
And do you still hate Satchel Paige?
It's a love-hate relationship. It's more love now since I'm finished, right? You know how it is. You can look back and you can say, okay, it's not at that moment when you're finally finishing up. I mean, there would be times I'm fixing to write a chapter on this guy, and I said, you know, heck, I don't know enough about Kansas City, Missouri. And then I look over there and say, my God, I got 18 books I got to read on Kansas City, Missouri, before I can actually write. It's probably going to be a small chapter. I got to, oh, shoot. So, I mean, you know, you say that, but at the same time, you really appreciate it because he helped fill out my education, yeah. Right? And that's, you know, being a university professor is a great, great privilege because the irony is when you put a book out there like Satchel Paige, which was originally almost 1,000 pages, and when you trim it down and work with copy editors and so forth, you put out only a fraction mm-hmm. of what you learned. And that's what I mean by the great privilege, just like you show up to teach a class and you tell them a little bit about what you know. On this subject, and you're actually paid and have the privilege of improving your mind, right, and doing what would be my hobby, which is my profession, but improving your mind, doing research, writing about it, and teaching about it. That's a great honor.
You've been listening to an interview with Don Spivey about his book, If You Were Only White, The Life of Leroy Satchel Paige, published by the University of Missouri Press in 2012. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects from science fiction to philosophy. If you like what you heard here, please follow New Books in Sports on Twitter or friend us on Facebook. You can give us your feedback, offer suggestions, and find links to thoughtful sports writing from around the world. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thank you for listening and enjoy your week.